The country will have a new president. I'm Jerry Barnash, and this is Here Now the News. Joe Biden is now president-elect after historic Election Day that went into the weekend before major networks could call Pennsylvania, thus projecting him over the top in the Electoral College. Kamala Harris is the first woman of color and first South Asian and, of course, first female vice president-elect. It ends several days of emotion that swung from exhaustion to euphoria. While Biden wins the highest position in the free world, President Trump has not been gracious, instead taking a low-bar approach, making baseless legal allegations in news conferences at the White House and on Twitter, most of which were flagged by the social media company. In today's episode, I'll talk to Hofstra University constitutional law professor James Sample about where we go in the coming weeks. Does Trump concede? Does he leave the White House January 20th on his own, or is he forced out? The professor and I will discuss if he actually has any avenues to fight his election loss, and even if the 25th Amendment could be used to stop his incendiary messaging. That's coming right up. Joining me now is Hofstra University constitutional law professor James Sample. And James, thanks for joining me, first of all, professor.
Thanks. It's great to be with you again, Jerry.
I want to tell the viewers, the listeners, we had done an interview for the podcast 2-3 weeks ago that was all centered around Speaker Pelosi's press conference about the 25th Amendment and transfer of power. And I thought this could still hold based on that, but depending on the election. But obviously, that whole playbook is thrown out, as much of what's going on right now in Washington. So I felt like we certainly had to do this a little bit fresher. As we're recording this, it's 11 o'clock in the morning on Friday, 3 days after the election, with Pennsylvania now is ahead now for Biden. And clearly he is on the precipice at this moment of becoming the president-elect. What we saw on Thursday night at the White House, the president speaking, I have to ask you, what do you make of that? Because it is, it certainly was very disturbing.
Disturbing is the most generous term that I think we can use, Jared. I mean, it was, I remember looking down at my watch specifically, 2:21 a.m. on Wednesday morning as the president was giving that speech. And, you know, to declare at that moment that he had won the election, number one. Number two, to make baseless claims about fraud and stolen votes and illegal this and illegal that, and to say that he was going to go straight to the Supreme Court. It was a tour de force of how an irresponsible leader in what we would like to think of as some other country acts when faced with the possibility of what America actually prides itself on, a potential peaceful transition of power. And to be clear, at that point, I actually thought, and it, you know, it was quite likely that he was going to win the election. And yet, even in that moment, and it was certainly uncertain whether he was going to win the election. And yet, even in that moment, he chose to prioritize self ahead of country to a degree that maybe we've never seen before in American history. That's a big statement, but if you think about it, you know, George Washington voluntarily stepped aside, and that is literally the moment when an uninterrupted string of peaceful transitions of power occurred in this country. It appears quite likely that Donald Trump is going to be leaving the White House. And it may or may not be leaving the White House with any form of dignity or class vis-a-vis his successor. But in that moment, it wasn't just Joe Biden that he was insulting. He was insulting what makes America, America.
Yeah, I mean, I've been waiting and wondering, and people have been saying about this pivot right from the campaign, from when he started, and you know, and not to make fun, but there's a Bugs Bunny cartoon with Yosemite Sam, and I'm being facetious, but it's true. Where there's I dare you to step over this line, I dare you to, and that sort of has been with the presidency, where you keep expecting, oh, he's gonna pivot, he's gonna act more presidential, And that was a moment. And certainly on Thursday, when he spoke after the former vice president spoke in Delaware, you thought maybe he'll be a unifier, even if he didn't concede at that point when he was still leading in Pennsylvania and Georgia. But, you know, at least say we're going to let all the votes get tallied and we're going to let the process run its course, which is what Biden said, although he did say, Biden, that he felt that he would have the votes ultimately to win. What did you think of when he spoke Thursday evening, which was even more? That was the one I was actually referring to. But yeah, both of them were very disturbing, I thought.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you know, it's interesting that you reference it. I'm actually go back a little bit towards the start of your comment there, because I hadn't thought about the Yosemite Sam image, but I actually felt all along for the last 6-7 months, number one, I was never at all sure who was going to come out on top in the election, but I felt that the adults in the room, so to speak, around the president, and even the president's own closest advisors and his family and his sort of self-interested crew would, if there was a loss in the election, step in and say, let's sort of look at this from the long-term perspective and the value of the country and all that. And not only has that not happened, I think the opposite has happened. There are some Republicans and there are some leaders who have been critical of his remarks, whether it was Wednesdays or Thursdays. But the truth is, you know, as we speak, as you said, today on Friday at 11 a.m., the list of Republican luminaries who have doubled down, tripled down on the irresponsible rhetoric and the claims. I mean, Newt Gingrich, you know, Ted Cruz, Lindsey Graham, I mean, there, Rudy Giuliani, there's a thread out there, not to mention the kind of right-wing media echo chamber universe that is talking about things that we as a nation would find troubling in a developing country. There's something going on in the inability of a huge portion of America. And listen, we both, you know, we're citizens and we're speaking as journalist and lawyer and you know, not as partisans, but in every single person's experience as a citizen, we've all been on losing sides of elections vis-a-vis our preferred candidates. It doesn't feel good, but I think about examples from both parties. I think about Al Gore in 2000 saying that he needed to go back to Tennessee and mend some fences. I think about John McCain shouting down the boos when he stepped up to give his concession speech to Barack Obama and talking about how we're all Americans. And I think of George H.W. Bush in 1992 saying, you know, this country, we believe so deeply in this country, we're going to do everything in our power to advance the interests of democracy by not engaging. The campaign is over. And so this isn't even just not having the ability to shake hands and say good game, as it were, to use a sports metaphor. They're actually trying to rewrite the rules to the game now. And you know, they're not having much success because they don't. To advance legal claims, you need either the law or the facts. And at the moment, they don't have either one.
By the way, a lot of those concession speeches, I've seen them now floating a lot. Yeah. Twitter. By the way, watch the McCain speech if you haven't listened to it or watch it. You'll get chills. I mean, you may tear up. I mean, people are there and they are booing when he's saying congratulations to President-elect Obama. And, you know, there's a ton of emotion and they're booing, and he immediately tamps that down. And by the end, they are cheering for the senator then to be president. And it's a classy, dignified display, and it's part of his legacy, along with that moment at a town hall when he said no ma'am, no ma'am. And it's a legacy of John McCain, and it shouldn't definitely at this point we should remember that. I want to ask you going forward now, again, as we're here on Friday, we don't know what's going to happen. And I think even, and you might agree with this, that even if the president at some point now decides to speak and concede, I think, would you agree the damage is done already?
Yeah. I mean, obviously, I'm hopeful for the good of the nation that some of the damage can be undone, but to a certain extent, you know, it's the old, you're better off doing the right thing the first time than doing the right thing only when you have absolutely no choice, right? It's the judges are in the criminal court context are fond of referencing the fact of just how many post-conviction pre-sentencing sort of, you know, revelations and, you know, and changes in persona exist in that moment. You know, I mean, self-interest is a powerful thing, but I think that partly, you know, let's be clear, this man has extraordinary support. You know, why was there not a blue wave? You know, I think because there was a blue wave and there was also a red wave. The level of Trump's support, Donald Trump got more votes in 2020 than he did in 2016. You know, he increased his total vote total. And that's not nothing. More Americans voted for him in 2020 after seeing and experiencing the last 4 years than voted for him in 2016. And, you know, Hillary Clinton was certainly a competent technocrat, but not well liked. And so you thought maybe some of the 2016 was kind of anti-Hillary vote. And certainly some of it was. But let's be clear, a huge, huge swath of the American people looked at what they saw for the last 4 years and said, I want more of that.
Right. And again, big numbers, obviously, with the pandemic, everybody, you know, a lot more people came out and it was polarizing, which brought out more people. And it's record numbers, a popular vote for either candidate. Yeah. They're both going to hit 70 million. And it was a record for Hillary Clinton 4 years ago, where she had that 3 million. It was the largest amount and it was the largest margin. And now it's going to be 4, possibly even a 5 million vote lead I guess I can say president-elect at this point, unofficially, but I mean, by the time we were doing this, for Joe Biden. And that shows you, and he's going to probably have 74, 75 million votes, which is, and again, both of them will have over 70 million. So that goes to the point you're saying about the Trump supporters. So right now, their words, they are saying legal fights for all of these different states. Is there any, as a constitutional lawyer, is there anything that they can, you know, really work on, that they have have any legal ground to work on?
One of my good friends, no longer lives in the New York area, and used to work together with him at the Brennan Center at NYU, a guy named Justin Levitt, said something the other day that I thought in one of the papers that I thought was just the absolute perfect quote. And he said, I may get it wrong slightly, but I want to make sure he gets the credit for it, which is just that he said, you know, a lawsuit without facts is a tweet with a filing fee. And that's all we've seen so far. And, you know, could the Republican Party or the presidential campaign, they can handle the filing fee in the court. But the reality is we've seen extraordinarily wild claims and we've seen no proof, no evidence. In fact, earlier this week in one of the challenges, the very claim that was asserted in a complaint in open court when being questioned by the judge, the attorneys walked it all the way back because the judge asked direct questions about, and by the end of it, I mean, it was literally, you're either going to face contempt of court or you're going to retract your statement. This is the old Wendy's commercial, where's the beef, kind of scenario with respect to these claims. And I say that not just because, you know, there hasn't been any, that the record is so thin and there's no evidence. If you have evidence of wrongdoing, prove it. That's our system. And the courthouse doors should be open for that kind of a claim. But there's also another factor, which is that, these parallels to Bush v. Gore and all that, you know, that was one state at that point. And there were a variety, and the margin in that state was 537 votes. here you're talking about the president declaring that there were legal challenges before the election is even over, right? And before election day is over, he was clearly telegraphing there were going to be challenges. And in some of them, the Republican Party is saying, let's stop the count. In other states, the president is saying, you know, we need to aggressively find the vote and count. And so it's been inconsistent. It's been contradictory. It's been an effort to have things both ways, and it's been unsupported by evidence. That's the state of the legal claims.
Right. And even when he spoke on Thursday night, he pointed out, in effect, that mail-in votes are fraudulent. I mean, that's a broad statement, but that, and he kind of set that stage weeks and months ago that he wanted, and that's why we're seeing the overwhelming mail-in votes are Democrat. And he told his rallies, his supporters, in effect, don't worry, you can go, you should go. And really that goes back to the whole narrative with COVID.
Oh, 100%. And you know, one of the amazing things here, and I think obviously a lot of these accommodations from a voting perspective were made because of the pandemic, and appropriately so. I think that this election cycle will have real ramifications in terms of changing the way we vote long term as well. And I think that the decision that the Trump campaign made to disparage and discourage mail-in voting will go down as a strategic error to be looked at through the years in you know, political strategy conferences and discussions. And you know, the reality is mail-in balloting is not new. 1 in 4 votes in 2016 was cast by a mail-in ballot. But this year, the volume was so much greater, and the emphasis was so much greater for obvious reasons. And it proved to be a tremendous tool. And I think you're going to see in the Georgia runoff election for the Senate, which may be for two seats, it appears, though there is going to be, certainly both sides are going to focus on on the state of Georgia to a degree that is going to be extraordinary. Historically, Democrats have not done well in off-cycle elections. The turnout has been low. But I suspect that this year, with the transition to this vote-by-mail combination, early voting, et cetera, and the stakes being so high, that could actually change. And I think that there is a shift here that goes beyond 2016, 2020, and beyond these two candidates. I think it will shift the way we conduct our elections over the long haul.
More of my conversation with James Sample coming up, including his reflection on this tweet by former Clinton Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. Biden has won. Trump won't concede. Since elections are officially over only when the loser concedes, this one will be going on until January 20th when Joe Biden is sworn in. Between now and then, Trump will make our lives as miserable as he can. Well, what's your reaction to that?
I'm scared to agree with it. I think he's absolutely right, and I think it is terrifying. I think that the lame duck period with this presidency and Mitch McConnell in the Senate will be unlike any lame duck period we've ever seen. And that may include judicial nominations. It may include executive action. And I think it will involve a level of aggressive behavior that is frankly terrifying.
Do you see any similarities? Obviously, this is a re-election and that is not, but do you see any similarities to this in Watergate?
Certainly from the pardon perspective, there's a real possibility that the president will use his pardon power to protect himself by pardoning any and everyone who could possibly cooperate against him in prosecutions that might come after Inauguration Day. That's one. There's talk that he might even try and pardon himself, which would be unprecedented, but I doubt that. I doubt that'll happen because I doubt that prosecutors will be foolish enough to bring any charges that they would bring in that kind of time frame. And realistically, from a Watergate perspective and a pardon perspective, there's nothing that the president's pardon power can do to protect him from state charges. And I think Letitia James and some state prosecutors around the country are really looking forward to having access to Donald Trump private citizen.
Right, because even if Vice President Mike Pence, even if he were to pardon the president, that will not, that's only federal, that's not for the state.
Exactly right, exactly right.
Do you see the president in any scenario where he resigns before January 20th?
It's a really good question. And, you know, I don't know the answer. I would say my instinct would say no. And yet the thing that is causing me pause is that every time I think it would take more humility for Donald Trump to do that than probably he has. I'm not a psychologist. Maybe there's a way that he proceeds to do it and, you know, give Mike Pence the power to effectively pardon him or give, you know, I,
right
there, you know, but you're sort of, that's delving into a level of understanding a particular individual's psychology that I simply lack.
Is there concern by the words that he's been using in tweeting the president? They're not only are they disturbing, but they're incendiary and it can cause violence.
Yes, there's absolutely a concern. And that's one of the things that I think is most unfortunate about the comments that we discussed at the top with respect to Wednesday morning and Thursday morning. And, you know, if you go on social media right now, or you go to Fox News, which I recommend people avoid as a general rule, but yes, I'm sure on conservative talk radio right now, you know, that, you know, there is a level of belief in baseless claims that is staggering. And then because those claims are baseless, they're not going to go anywhere. And then the frustration is always, there's always frustration when what you believe to be true is not remedied, when a wrong that you perceive doesn't get fixed. Well, these wrongs aren't going to get fixed because there's nothing to fix. There's not the predicate doesn't exist. And so when people feel as though they've been wronged and nothing is being done about it, they tend to get violent. And the truth is, this president has, at the very least, courted and coddled and maybe, you know, maybe directly encouraged, but it's certainly not discouraged violence. I mean, we can go back to Charlottesville. We can go to, you know, the rhetoric is, if not directly supportive of violence, it is at least accommodating of violence.
As we talked at the top, the reason we were going to start this first interview a few weeks ago was about the 25th Amendment. Is there a case to be made right now to remove the president or at least to put a hearing together for a 25th Amendment? Is there a case based on the way he's acting now?
My take on that would be that as a strategic matter, if I were, let's say, a Democrat or even a centrist independent, my take on that would be that it would be counterproductive and that the best way to remove Donald Trump from office is the way that 70 million people just did. I think that rejection of the president and of what he stands for, I think the people of Georgia, if Georgia ends up in the Trump column when all the dust settles, I think the people of Pennsylvania, assuming Pennsylvania goes to Vice President Biden, I think the people, frankly, in Omaha, Nebraska, you know, with one electoral vote in the split non-winner-take-all system, you know, I think that those people rejected the president in a way that is probably the best and most effective way. I supported the impeachment back at the beginning of this year, which feels like a couple decades ago. I felt it was the right thing to do. I felt it was right on the law and right on the principles. I was very much with Mitt Romney. I wasn't relishing impeachment. It's a horrible thing. But the facts were there. The case was made. And the only reason facts weren't there in certain instances is because they'd been obstructed. I mean, imagine a criminal defendant being able to say, well, this witness can testify against me, but that one you can't listen to. You can't have access to this document. You can't hear from so-and-so. You can't hear. It's the criminal defense dream. And that's how impeachment proceeded. And the Senate allowed it to proceed in that way. They You know, and the Supreme Court, frankly, said we're not going to step in, even though that's kind of why we have a Supreme Court. When we have a dispute between the legislative and executive branch, we really need a third party. So I think the 25th Amendment was a credible conversation to have for Speaker Pelosi. I think, and ultimately, I think probably the nation needs to address some procedures under the 25th Amendment that you and I discussed previously. On the other hand, I think the most powerful way to show Donald Trump the door is at the ballot box, and that's what happened.
And the only reason I asked that, and I know that at this point would be really just probably a long shot to be sure, but I just thought because this the baseless claims that he's making, and as I said, the incendiary remarks that you know are potentially there. So I just thought like if there's a way to just you know extricate him earlier, but you don't think that's
sensible. It would take his own advisors. It would take Mark Meadows. It would take
right.
And we've seen the opposite, right? We've seen them sort of stand up and say that you know, I mean, they're very much with him, even in the portions where Republican Party members, you know, luminaries. When Chris Christie is saying, I think that was way out of line what the president just did. That tells you that there's a certain segment of the Republican Party that thinks this is really, really getting out of hand and really dangerous. But you haven't seen that from the president's closest friends.
And I wonder if as these days go on, if they, you know, keep talking legal challenges and fraud, if you're going to start to see separation between the Republicans, the president, the White House, the aides, the president, and start to get the president on the right page, on the right side of history with this.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I would have, you know, I would have thought that Lindsey Graham coming off a surprisingly resounding victory would have, and seeing that the president is likely on his way out, would have taken this as an opportunity to kind of go have a clean break from, go back to Lindsey Graham part one, as opposed to Lindsey Graham part two, but apparently Lindsey Graham part three is gonna be more like two than one. And so, you know, it's possible. In some ways, maybe I've lost a little bit of faith in what I perceive, you know, what I would call the responsible Republican. You know, we talked about John McCain earlier. I think, sadly, and I'm not happy to say this, I think Senator McCain is gone, not just in body, but in spirit in the Republican Party today.
I just want to ask you, do you see, ultimately, I think if all the numbers hold for the different states, Biden could wind up with the reverse of what Trump had 4 years ago, 305 to 226 or 223. I forget the number exactly,
yeah.
But it was whatever it was 4 years ago. It would be the same thing. Is there any way? Obviously, we know that Trump is a fighter to the end, and he doesn't want to let go. Can this go to a battle at the Electoral College?
It could. It would take, if there were one state, if the margin were smaller than the margin that you're describing, I think you would probably see at least a concerted effort by some in the president's camp to encourage electors to be so-called faithless electors, where they don't follow the will of their state voters. And you've seen some chatter about, you know, Mark Levine, for example, has encouraged legislators around the country to ignore the will of their voters and to appoint their own electors to the college. That's actually not something they can do at this juncture. If a state legislature wants to declare that in the 2024 electoral college, the legislature rather than the voters will choose the electors, they can do that. But what they can't do is change the rules after Election Day, where Election Day was, where the rules were that the voters would choose the electors. The level of backlash if electors in a state, in a state or states ignored the will of the people, then I think we'd be talking about, you know, a level of all-out civil discord that we don't even want to contemplate.
And with that in mind, will the president transfer this power peacefully? Will he at all, or will they have to bring in marshals and police and Secret Service? How do you envision this ending?
I always thought that the answer to that would be yes. And maybe the answer is the president goes peacefully, but just doesn't show up at the inauguration because it'd be too much for his, you know, not his narcissistic non-humility or something. But I do think that the power of the nation as a whole, the power of the circumstance, the power of the ceremony, the power of structural inertia will prove greater than the power of his ego. So whether he chooses to go kicking and screaming or whether he chooses to go peacefully, he's going to go.
Well, I really thank you for this.
Thank you.
In these historic times to get this perspective. It's really helpful.
Thank you. It's a pleasure speaking with you always, Jerry.
Thank you so much. James Sample, again, he is a constitutional law professor at Hofstra University. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe, and if you could share any episodes, that would be great too. You can contact with any feedback, including interview suggestions, on Twitter at Jerry Barmash or email hearnowthenewsjb@gmail.com. Join our Hear Now the News Facebook page for more. Like what you hear? Please give a 5-star rating and review if you use Apple as your podcast platform of choice. Another way to help this podcast grow is giving a much appreciated donation. In future episodes, more focus on the next presidential administration and surges in the coronavirus. Thanks for listening to Hear Now the News. I'm Jerry Barmash.